Okay, good morning. The administration committee meeting will now begin. For the record, this is a virtual meeting and all board members and participants are by telephone. For the record, I will now take roll call. Board Member Morocco?
Here.
Board Member Adams?
Here.
Board Member Ajmani?
Here.
Board Member Gordon?
Here.
Board Member Rasmussen?
Here.
Thank you. And Board Member Greaves is absent at today's meeting. Board members, at this time, we will ask for public comments on the agenda. 2 minutes per speaker. I will now ask Joseph Cliff to provide his comments. Is Joseph Cliff on the line?
Can you hear me?
Yes, now I can hear you. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Good morning. First wanted to say that I really regret hearing of Ray Kenny's passing. I knew him, the Long Island Railroad, and the fact that he came out of retirement to come to work and run rail ops at New Jersey Transit, I think, is what indirectly killed him, his commute between New Jersey and Lindenhurst, Long Island. I'm just really saddened to hear that. Regarding the agenda today, I don't see any discussion in the agenda of the guidance from the state on how to deal with the COVID financial crisis. I know local communities have been told to look at a five-quarter year that takes them through September 30th to assume that they get no extra money from the state. So I don't see anything in here as far as this group is supposed to be the thinking arm of the board on financial issues. I don't see anything about that, but I would like to know what the guidance has been from the state. Are you all going to do 15 months without additional money? I don't know. But the future does look bleak. And just to make a specific point, by the way, there's no breakdown of March numbers in the financials. You've got year-to-date, but no March, which makes it harder to look at things. But if you look at the fiscal 21 plan, the revenue is forecast at $1 billion. State support is forecast at $800 million. So $1.8 billion a year comes from the state or directly from the customers. And the $1.4 billion you got from the feds on the CARES Act, if you think about the math, you're looking at 9 months equivalent. So I would like to know, is the state going to reduce its direct operating support? Is the Turnpike going to be unable to give you the money they normally give you because their revenues are way down? But it would be really nice to see some thinking ahead and discussion. I said at the last committee meeting, I feel like I'm watching people on the Titanic looking backwards or currently at what the situation is instead of forwards at what you're going to do next. Transit's in a real pickle here, especially the long-time travel, like the hour service that you have, people sitting for an hour on a train. But it would be nice to see on the financial side and on the operating side what you plan to do, what the thinking is now about the future. And one last point, I doubt that New Jersey Transit has shared with the board members, but on Sunday, New York Governor Cuomo put the stake in the heart of the tunnel project for Gateway. They've repaired the Canarsie tunnels nights and weekends in a year for a couple hundred million dollars. The same thing can be done to the Hudson tunnels. That completely destroys the argument for building the Hudson Tunnel project at $10 billion. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Next is the financial update, Jeff Bernstein.
Thank you, Joyce, and good morning, board members, and staff, and the public. The monthly report has taken a slightly different format this month as we present pertinent details regarding COVID-19-related impacts, which began in mid-March. Additional details not presented and discussed can be found in the appendix. For the 9 months ending March 31st, 2020, New Jersey Transit net loss from operations was $200,000, less a $6.9 million loss related to the timing of reimbursable private revenue. This compares to last year, where we reported a $9.4 million gain from operations and a $3.2 million loss due to the timing of reimbursable project revenue. This also compares to last month, where we reported a $22.3 million gain from operations. Compared to budget, net income from operations is unfavorable by $1.9 million, This includes unfavorable operating revenue of $15.9 million, while expenses were favorable to budget by $14 million. Passenger revenue is $20 million, or 2.7% below budget, and has been significantly impacted by the dramatic reductions in ridership due to the COVID-19 pandemic. On a year-to-date basis, revenue from rail operations is $14.5 million lower than budget, or 3.4%. Revenue from bus operations is $4.7 million, or 1.6% below budget. And revenue from light rail operations is $800,000, or 4.7% lower than budget. On a monthly basis, all revenue across all modes has experienced steep and substantial declines, which will be discussed in greater detail on a later slide. On the expense side, labor and fringe expenses were favorable to budget by $2.8 million, or 0.3%. Favorable regular wages due to vacancies was partially offset by overtime for service coverage. Again, that's on a year-to-date basis. Purchase transportation costs are $5.7 million, or 3.4% below budget. The $2 million increase in the favorable variance between last month and this month were primarily due to service interruptions with our contract carriers due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Specifically, access link service and demand has experienced a gradual decrease of about 60%. This is a trend that we anticipate will continue through April and beyond, similar to the rest of our ridership. Other expenses were favorable by $5.5 million and 1.2%. Increased spending has occurred this month with COVID-19-related expenditures, which show up in this category. Items such as personal protection equipment, gloves, masks, cleaning supplies, those will all be reflected here. We expect a significant increase in these costs as the month of April progresses or finishes and into May, June, and beyond. These increased costs are, however, on a year-to-date basis, are offset by a combination of items, including lower-than-budgeted contracted maintenance service and electronic equipment service costs, lower interest expense as our line of credit was at zero for a substantial portion of the beginning of the fiscal year, and lower equipment rental costs. On the next slide, which reports the monthly variance to budget of selected major items, the major takeaway from this slide is the illustration of the effect that the COVID-19 pandemic has had on our passenger revenue, which is $28.6 million lower than prior months, resulting from an over 90 to 95% decrease in ridership over the last half of the month. The third slide, this slide further illustrates the precipitous revenue and ridership declines throughout the month of March. Steep declines began on Thursday, March 12th, as the impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic hit the greater New York, New Jersey area, and work from home and social distancing guidelines began to be implemented. The declines reached 91% and 96% at the end of March for bus and rail, respectively. And while not on the slide, have reached declines of 94% for bus and 98% for rail in April. At the end of March, rail weekday sales had slumped from just over $1 million a day to about $40,000 a day. Bus weekday sales were down from $500,000 a day to also about $41,000 a day. And our monthly ticket refund requests were over six times our normal refund rate. Just to give a note on monthly tickets, while they are refundable, given the discount, only the unused portion is refunded. Therefore, monthly tickets had little to no value remaining by the time they were submitted for refunds, specifically regarding the timing where the ridership declines really began around the middle of the month. April 2020, however, monthly ticket sales are 90% and 98% below April 2019 sales for bus and rail, respectively. The next slide, our operating cash balance at March 31st, 2020 was $115 million, a $104 million increase from February. This increase was primarily due to the receipt of $64.5 million of funding from the New Jersey Turnpike Authority and a pre-planned drawdown of $70 million on the line of credit. As a result of the $70 million drawdown, on March 31, 2020, we had $115 million outstanding out of $300 million available on the credit facility. Our corresponding long-term debt balance was $1,267 million. The next slide further elaborates on New Jersey Transit's cash position and liquidity. Our current cash on hand is enough to cover our operating expenses through approximately mid-June, with daily cash outlays of typically between $8.5 million and $10 million. Earlier this week, we received $200 million of expected federal grant funding, with this has been included in our cash on hand projection. The following are highlights from the actions we are taking to maintain and to strengthen our cash position. We are monitoring our cash balances daily, and we are working with our vendors to ensure they are paid within the terms of their respective contracts, but not earlier than contractually required. New Jersey Transit has received an allocation of $1.435 billion through the CARES Act. As to note, these funds are not automatically deposited in our account, however, and they require submitting and the FTA approving a grant application, then our requesting reimbursement for eligible expenses after those expenses occur. Our CARES Act grant application was submitted to the FTA on Monday, April 27th, and is currently with the Federal Department of Labor awaiting their certification. The earliest we are expecting funds to be delivered under the CARES Act is in late May. In addition to the CARES Act, we are also pursuing potential reimbursement opportunities with FEMA. And lastly, we are working with Bank of America to increase our federal grant back line of credit. To the last and final slide, significant efforts by our IT department have helped sustain the continuity of our business functions, as most administrative staff is now working remotely. Selections of these initiatives include replacing end-of-life desktops with laptops, moving our email service to the cloud and rolling out Microsoft Teams and OneDrive, upgrading our VPN as remote access needs expanded rapidly, and providing email addresses and network credentials to the remaining 8,000 unionized operations employees who did not yet have access. Thank you, and that concludes my report.
Thank you, Jeff. I will now ask board members for questions and comments. Board Member Morocco?
No questions, thank you.
Okay. Board Member Adams?
No questions or comments.
Okay. Board Member Ashmani?
Yes, I have a question. Jeff, the $1.4 billion that's going to come from the federal government, does it come with any conditions like it has to be used in a certain way or it's a reimbursement for certain expenses? What are the conditions around it?
Yes, it does. The expenses must be eligible for federal reimbursement, which typically our labor will be considered eligible and the fringe associated with that. We do require waivers, however, for some of our non-labor items, as those were not procured with appropriate federal language. We are working with the FTA to ensure that those waivers are in place. This funding is a reimbursement, so we incur the expense and then request the reimbursement from the FTA, and does not require a local match.
And Dini, this is Bill. There are some expenses that we incur that we expect will not be eligible, notwithstanding waiver requests. Many of those we will look to FEMA to see if we can be reimbursed from FEMA. FEMA's 75% reimbursement, so our approach to being reimbursed is really looking to the CARES Act first, FEMA, and then potentially insurance claims and other grants to the extent they become available in more or less in that order.
Thanks, Bill. And is there a timeline as to this money must be spent by a certain time?
No.
Thank you.
Okay, Board Member Gordon, any questions or comments?
I do. Thank you very much. Related to the CARES Act, I had a couple of questions. I had or observations. I had a conversation with folks at the National Council of State Legislatures on the CARES Act, and they had indicated that there's a great deal of flexibility in these funds. I'm sure that there are some things that the funds can't be used on, but they said for most states and most transit agencies, there's going to be a good deal of flexibility in what the money could be spent on. In fact, this person said in the case of New Jersey, you might even be able to use the money to offset the drawdown or the shift of capital funds to operating. I do have a basic question about the CARES funding. Senator Booker refers to 1.7 million plus going to New Jersey Transit. The Eno Center did a report this week showing the allocations by state, and the figures for New Jersey are over 1.7 billion. There is, and yet I know Kevin at his COVID briefing referred to 1.4 billion plus. I think it was 1.436. And I'm just wondering what's the discrepancy between the numbers? It's about 200 million. Are we counting different things? Can you help me with that?
Yeah, Bob, this is Bill. So regarding your first comment on flexibility, I would agree in general the way the CARES Act is worded, and the intent certainly seems to be to provide a great deal of flexibility, including being able to use it on capital expenses potentially. So we will certainly take full advantage of that. On the second question regarding the $1.7 billion, the original $1.7 billion really related to what the CARES Act had appropriated to the state of New Jersey, not specifically New Jersey Transit. So there was some confusion, I think, in the public domain around that issue. We go through a process of splitting funds with partner agencies in the region, including SEPTA, MTA, and Connecticut. So the difference between the 1.45, roughly, and the 1.7 is the allocation of part of that 1.7 that goes to our partner agencies in the region.
Okay, thank you. I thought that's what Kevin said, I think I missed the details. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Board Member Rasmussen, any questions or comments?
No questions, no comments. Thank you.
Thank you. Next is the Human Resources Update, Jean Victor.
Good morning. This is Jean Victor, Chief of Human Resources. This is my first open administration committee meeting since we've been directed to work from home. Before I go over my dashboard numbers, I thought I should note that since we've started working from home, HR has become much more adept at working without paper. HR has also become much more adept at using Microsoft Teams to hold meetings, and I must admit, we all seem to be much more productive of late. We've been working on a number of major initiatives as of late. Since the coronavirus struck, our medical and EAP departments have been working on overdrive to work with employees diagnosed positive with COVID-19 to help them get back to the point of returning to work. We've had to modify our approach to learning and development to accommodate remote learners, and we've had to modify our hiring process to bring on critical hires remotely. I'll specifically address the hiring process. Since the coronavirus struck and we realized the severity of the situation, we've been scrutinizing every new hire and promotion. All positions are first reviewed by HR, and then HR and finance meet weekly to review those positions that are ready to be filled. The purpose of the meeting with finance is to determine which of those positions, if any, will move forward in the process at this time. Although all open positions are on our list, we determined to prioritize those positions deemed critical. We then established criteria to guide us in determining which of those positions are critical. Those criteria include whether the position must be filled for reasons of compliance, whether we're filling a PTC position for rail, or whether the position is federally funded. So if you look at my report, you'll see that in February, we had a total of 334 positions to fill. Of that total, we filled 85 positions, or 25%. Of the positions that we filled, nearly all of them were agreement positions, 40 of which were bus cleaners, operators, and servicemen. On the rail side, a large proportion of those positions that are shown were filled with a class of 20 assistant conductors. If you compare those numbers to March, you'll see that we had 323 positions to fill. Of those, we filled 101 of them, or 31%. Of the positions that we filled, the vast majority were, again, agreement positions, with 47 in bus, largely comprising bus cleaners, operators, and servicemen, and 24 locomotive engineer trainees. Just to put that into context, although the numbers for April, are, you haven't seen them and they're not yet final, as of April 27th, we've only filled a total of 31 positions, 27 of which were bus operators, cleaners, and servicemen. These positions were in the pipeline before the coronavirus struck, and I would dare say bus would say they were critical to their operations. The next line in my report shows promotions. The 26 promotions in rail operations, which I'll just note here, in February were largely comprised of a class of locomotive engineers. If you compare that with the March numbers, the number of promotions in March was relatively light for that month. If you look at the next line of job, the next line, which is job classifications, there were 14 job classifications in February. They were all comprised of bus agreement personnel. If you look at the next line of retirements, the number that really sticks out for me is 53 for bus. The reason why there's so many retirements for bus in February is largely because when bus operators determine that they're going to retire, they typically take their vacation in January and then retire in February. If you look at bus retirements in March, you'll see that the number is much lower. The next line, which is with respect to other separations, the numbers seem pretty consistent to me across the board. Lastly, with respect to disciplinary actions, you'll note that the numbers largely reflect disciplines of agreement employees on the bus and rail sides. That concludes my report.
Thank you, Jean. Board Member Morocco, any questions or comments?
Just a couple questions. Thank you for the report. It's my understanding that there were some payroll issues related to kind of reliance on some archaic kind of paper-based systems. Could you just give us a summary of what's being done to address those issues?
I don't handle payroll. That's handled by finance.
Yeah, so I can offer a comment on that. And while I would tend to agree, we have some upgrading to do on our payroll systems. The vast majority of the issues we had with getting paychecks out accurately had to do with many of the staff who do the upfront work, data entry, verification, being hit very significantly by COVID. We had a great deal of absences in those areas. And technically, those are not payroll folks, but they are critical parts of the functioning of the payroll apparatus. Because of a lot of those absences, the data that got to the payroll department was in some cases either incomplete or incorrect, leading to gaps. We are, I'd say knock on wood, in much better shape today than we were 2 weeks ago in those areas.
Okay. So was that an issue that was, I guess, limited to the strains that are caused by the crisis and the absenteeism? Is that where the breakdown happened?
Yes.
Or a technological issue?
No, it was really COVID related. Generally, and it's kind of, looking at payroll and upgrading the systems that we use and the processes is something that is on our list of things to evaluate, but normally we would not have these kinds of strains. So outside of COVID, we tend to work through the systems types of issues. We rarely have significant issues with getting people paid accurately and getting paid on time. So it is directly related to COVID.
Yeah, obviously, to the extent that the crisis has kind of revealed some susceptibilities to strain in the payroll system or some areas where it could be updated and kind of made more efficient, obviously, I think that's an opportunity worth taking to improve those. The second question I have, and I'm not sure really who this is directed, is engineering training continuing? Planned, or is that being affected by the crisis?
Yeah, Rich, it's Kevin. I can let Jimmy Sincaglia is on. He's taking over from Ray, Jim's head of rail op. But just two quick comments. One on the payroll run question. Certainly, we have, it is still very heavily manual. It was routine. So COVID threw it off that routine. But part of our IT plans upgrades, also including fare collection, we've been working with union to, start getting, scanners, cell phone scanners kind of thing, do a lot of this stuff, payroll information, being able to do that in technology. So that is one of our priority items that we're sort of in the middle of until this hit. But as Bill said on the payroll side, that was, directly due to, absenteeism rooms where people were, stuff we reported on before, for the current things. But a lot of that could be solved with upgrades in technology. The second thing with the engineer, the LETP training programs, we have kept those. They're critical to go. We've adjusted them for, COVID-19 conditions, both onboarding by sending people laptops for doing what they can do academically in home, et cetera, and then also making sure appropriate social distancing for those who are doing, out in on-the-job training out in the field. But, Jim, do you want to get into some of the details on that?
Yeah, sure, Kevin. You basically covered everything. We shifted majority of our training to home learning. So the rail training department is now doing virtual training for the locomotive engineers and for the conductor training. We did take a little bit of a pause with some of the field training for the engineers just for the social distancing. But that is going to be kicking back off. We actually had some meetings yesterday. Where we'll be, starting to schedule those classes that were getting close to graduating, setting up their riding assignments and their check rides. But most of the training has continued. There'll be probably a small setback, just can't cover as much material doing home learning as you can in a classroom setting. But all the training is continuing.
Thank you.
Okay, Board Member Adams, any questions or comments?
Yes, Joyce, I do have two questions. And the HR director's first name is Jean, am I correct?
Yes, Jean Victor.
Okay. Jean, I have a question. You described the process or procedure that you're going through now to fill open positions. And I think I remember you saying that HR reviews the candidate, and then it goes to finance. But I didn't hear any part of the process that it went to the actual requesting department or division. I'm just confused why finance would be there before bus or rail or whomever or engineering, whoever requested it would be, unless you just gave me the abbreviated process. I just need to know, what's the whole process?
Well, the process is that the bus or rail or whichever one of the divisions is requesting to fill a position, they would submit a requisition. We would have a recruiter work with the hiring manager to try to fill that position. We post it. We conduct interviews. We ultimately will select a candidate. And then the recruiter will prepare the paperwork that paperwork would then go to me to review to see if we're going to be moving forward with that person. We've just implemented this procedure in the last month or so due to the coronavirus with this additional review as to whether or not we were going to go forward, because prior to that, we were trying to fill all the vacancies that we had. After I review it, then I meet with finance. You know, we meet with finance to talk about whether or not this is a position that we want to move on right now, or if this is a position that should be on hold.
Okay, Jean, can I just stop you there? That's
yeah.
where I have difficulty. What input is finance going to give me as a rail or bus manager or an engineering department manager to say that my position is not critical? What is finance going to add to the process at that point?
Finance gives us the perspective of funding at this point. The question is whether or not we want to take on an additional employee. Do we have the additional funding at this point to do that?
Well, it's almost like
Gene,
of course we don't. Yes.
Yeah, it's Kevin. Maybe I can give you a little background from when I came in. That'd be worthwhile, the context. And the finance, obviously, you have positions. We do an annual budget, and you have, every department has their budget, and you have the normal budget tug of war, headcount, other expenditures. So, headcount, but then you have authorized positions. But when I came in, there were, hundreds and hundreds of positions that were unfilled. But when we started digging in, and a lot of those positions were on paper on an org chart, but in fact, and they showed the positions unfilled, but what they had done to work around the restrictions that were applying, in the previous administration, were to be hiring outside people or hiring employees, have them retire, and then hire them back the next day kind of thing as consultants. So there was a lot of stuff that was showing up in the budget that would show up as, consulting costs for, the department that in fact were just employees that they couldn't backfill. So they switched, the retired employees. So there was a lot of stuff like that cleaned up. So we had, for finance, the actual positions and needs are in the budget. It's fairly routine if it's filling, basic positions, right? The bus drivers or, the different positions that we'll have. But, you have to make sure that there's money in the budget, because there was a lot of finagling the bagel, for lack of scientific terminology or financial terminology, of were positions actually funded. We showed we had all these vacancies, but in fact, they were never funded because the funds that were available were being used for consultants or quote-unquote consultants. So that's where, the positions had to be verified that there is funding for that position and that money hadn't been reallocated somewhere else.
Okay. Now, what you said makes sense, and I don't want to prolong my questions, but in the future, I would like to see an acknowledgement of the position being funded before all this work is done. But that's a separate issue. So let me move on into my other question. Nate, since we have such a high unemployment rate in New Jersey, I would think we would make, and subject to budget constraints, make a more concerted effort to fill our positions, because there's a lot of high-quality people who are now unemployed. So I'm imploring HR to be able to look to some of those people to possibly fill these positions. And that's a comment, not a question. The last comment I have is about, and I'm going to bring it up, is the payroll issue. Either Bill or Kevin, I've heard the long-term solution, and I agree with you 100%. But what do I tell the frontline employees is the reasons why what happened before will not happen again during this crisis? What have we done?
James, a number of steps. I know, Bill, if you want to take that, but one of the things was where we had, particularly on the rail side, people who wear the payroll verification was a small room with people packed in. And I think, as you know, one of those people contracted COVID-19 and, in fact, passed away.
Yes.
So that department was particularly hard hit. At the same time, that the assignments, because of the dramatic change in our reduction in service levels, the assignments were not routine. Also, other payments, you know, people even turning in their timesheets, since that's manual. There were a number of different things that had, but they sort of backed up on that verification, you know, extra, if you're a flag, if you do flag work, that's a different category. So there were a lot of things that got backed up, and those have been addressed by moving, one, people being able to come back, cross-training, and then relocating those people into a different office that much more spacious, where they're spread out, with, you know, more than ample social distancing, so that can do that, and doing it in teams. So if one team gets knocked out, you know, have to all go on quarantine, that it doesn't, we don't have a backup. So those were some of the things. But I don't know, Bill, if you want to go into some more details on the actual process.
So one thing I would add to that is we have added resources, partly because of the so many people working from home. We have found in some cases there are some staff who can't who find themselves with extra capacity. So for example, we've taken three staff from finance and repositioned them to focus on in particular FMLA. Payroll-related issues. I know Rail has also added two or three folks whose normal job would not be focused on payroll in order to augment those resources. As some of the impacted workers are coming back to work, we've also made sure that they are not working in close quarters, and so we've set up space in either a large conference room, in cases of a handful of people, and others they are working from home. So rather than having these groups who would normally be working closely together, they are now distanced from one another. Should there be a reoccurrence, they would not be, or they'd be that much less likely to be working closely together and having the same situation. So the other thing I would add is, in terms of which is a little bit longer term, is we are looking at technology solutions. NeoGov is a particular software solution that HR is looking at. I think Jeannie is, Quan is on the call. If Jeannie wants to talk about what, you know, NeoGov's capabilities are, that might also help to address the question. Volunteer her to jump in if she's on.
Sure. Thanks, Bill. Hi. So this is Jeannie Quan. Yes. So we are looking, and we have had meetings, and certainly we know from an overall comprehensive and strategic perspective, we need to modernize our systems. We need to bring on a platform that is going to bring all of these processes, including payroll, online. So we have been doing that during this time. It is a big lift. It is not inexpensive. And we have been talking to various vendors. Will it solve, you know, this, will it solve for every single process in the chain of the payroll? Those details we have to work through as regards to verification, you know, time cards and such, and there are processes that will have to be implemented. But I think considering the circumstances, unprecedented pandemic, you know, our comeback from this will also largely be in terms of adding the resources, looking at the investments that we can bring in to make sure that we are all fluent in doing these things online and from home if need be in the future. I hope that answers your question. In addition, I just wanted to add some color to the comment in terms of the regular HR and finance meetings. These are meetings that we have on a regular basis with myself and Bill Vaccaro, our CFO, Gene Victor, head of HR, one of Bill's deputies, one of Gene's deputies. This is an added layer of control. We do not want to lose the progress that we have made over these past 2 years in filling our vacancies. Rest assured, the hiring managers and the departments are involved along every step of the way. But we need to have an extra level of control in terms of our finances. You'll notice some other agencies have put on hiring freezes. We have not done that. We are using very selective criteria to make sure that we are moving forward. And in terms of your last comment, Board Member Adams, in terms of hiring the now available supply of talent in New Jersey, that is something, certainly something we would look to do, and it's also part of our strategic goals in terms of building an organization that for New Jersey that delivers for New Jersey.
Okay. Thank you all for your comments. Joyce, I have no other comments or questions.
Okay, thank you. Board Member Ajmani, any questions or comments? Board Member Gordon, any questions or comments?
None from me.
Thank you. Board Member Gordon?
Yeah, just an observation. If one looks at the North Highland report, I believe dated October of 2018, in the chapter on personnel, the recommendations that really came out to me were, one, the need to move from a manual to an automated system, which we've discussed, but also the need to streamline the recruiting and job fulfillment process. The report pointed to, at least in the opinion of the consultants, to steps that were unnecessary. And when this crisis passes, I think I would certainly find it helpful, I suspect my colleagues on the board as well, just to hear where transit is in implementing those recommendations, if they in fact are. I assume you didn't accept everything, but I'd be interested in you know, seeing where we are in terms of information technology and in, improving the process of filling positions itself. I have no other questions. Thanks.
I can actually address that right now if you like. We took that very seriously. It was a very important problem that we had in HR. And while Jeannie Kwan just mentioned that we're trying to update our technology, we took an interim step by putting in what we call Target Recruit. And it's like a modified ATS system that allows us to handle a large number of applicants and applications that come into New Jersey Transit and are able to better, put those into the correct, and put them with the correct recruiter and get them processed correctly. That was a huge help. It was a huge step in helping us break away from the paper-bound applications that we were getting and to try to move to a more electronic system. We did that, plus we streamlined to the effect that we've added additional staff. We have oversight by a number of our staff members. In the past, we had oversight by one person. So that was a point where every single job vacancy that we were trying to fill had to be funneled through one person to be reviewed, and that greatly slowed down the process. I think we've made tremendous strides in removing a lot of the obstacles that were in our way before. And one other thing I might note is that we separated our recruiting process into two pieces. We have our sourcers and those people that go out and find the candidates, and then we created a candidate experience team that handles the candidate from the time that the offer is made and accepted to the time that the candidate becomes an employee and sits down in their seat. So we let the recruiters be recruiters. We created a team to handle the paperwork and move the candidate forward through the process and to get them onboarded and through the orientation. And I think it has been much smoother. It's been much more efficient. And I think we were able to meet a lot of our hiring goals over the last year or so because we made those changes that were recommended. Thank you.
Thank you. That was very helpful.
And Bob, the only thing I would add to what Gene said, and we didn't highlight it today because it didn't seem quite as relevant as it has over the past 2 years, but pages 9 and 10 of the presentation that was handed out for the meeting does provide numbers related to vacancies as well as hiring, and you can see the trends. We're at a low point for quite a long period of time in what our vacancy rate actually is as a result of the efforts that we've put into onboarding staff.
Hi. Thanks.
And I would just, it's Jeannie Kwan speaking again. So I would just like to add that as the follow-up to that assessment that North Highland did, we did bring on an implementation consultant that was a McKinsey was the prime. And, you know, so the tasks that we had for human resources to address all the recommendations in the North Highland report, we have come a very long way, still not totally completed yet. But in terms of all the process revamping, we took a look at all of the current processes, including those that we have for recruiting. The team has created to-be processes, so future state processes, and now we are in the stage of implementing those. And obviously, this is all happening when everybody's working double time on the coronavirus, but they have done incredible work. We do have a time-to-fill metric, which is basically probably like a third of what it originally was in the North Highland report. We can come back to you with that current metric because I don't know what the current numbers exactly are on those, but we do have goals for time to fill, and we have come a long way. I'll leave it at that. I hope that answers some of your questions.
Yeah, very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Board Member Rasmussen, any questions or comments?
Yeah, I just want to make sure that I got this straight. It sounded like you increased the staffing at the payroll on the rail side by two or three people, if I heard that correctly. So I'm curious as to determine whether or not we felt that we were understaffed in that department, and that became really apparent through the crisis of COVID-19, and if those two or three additional staffing are going to be on a temporary basis or on a permanent basis.
I'll ask Jimmy if he can comment on that. I think, I mean, you know, from my perspective, the issue with the additional staff was more to augment what the resources that have been depleted as a result of COVID, not necessarily gotten to the point where it's obvious it's a long-term part of the solution. But in the interim, we also had much to do to catch up with work. Payroll has been working the finance part of payroll has been working 7 days a week for the last several weeks. That's not necessarily sustainable for that group. Similarly, for the timekeepers and verification units, the people who were in the office. So we have, one of the things we've been doing in general, but specifically for paychecks, is trying to identify staff that has additional bandwidth to help where needed. And in this case, clearly, it made sense to lend some help in those areas.
Yeah, Dave, it's Kevin. Maybe I just say, you know, from the bigger picture, is I think, as you know better as well as anyone, if not better, you know, we have a very complex, traditional, heavily paper, particularly on the rail side, but also to a degree on bus. You know, paper, very paper centric. You know, in a lot of aspects in rail, whether it be the MMC or whether it be, you know, for crews, et cetera. And but when it's routine, it goes on a routine, you know, from what we've seen, that generally has worked well. But we want to modernize it for, you know, all sorts of reasons. And this COVID crisis has highlighted why we want to modernize it. You know, some people don't like modernizing, but they like staying with the old way, both on the management side as well as on the crew side. But, you know, it clearly, things like this show the weakness of relying on, you know, so heavily on those paper systems. So that's a longer thing to transition to. What do we, how that is IT, how much that's IT, how much of it's jobs in the field, you know, the individual jobs. You have to look at that holistically. Is how do we really get a good, efficient system that allows people, and even if we change different assignments, allows them to get paid properly and, you know, get the input in easily, you know, even remotely, you know, if it can be verified, those kind of things. So that's a bigger management, you know, holistic view of payroll, and that involves IT as well.
But as far as those positions, to Bill's point, we need to make sure, this whole social distancing and what offices are going to look like in the future. But in the short term, the coronavirus, having, a small, tight group in a tight space without redundancy clearly showed, in a situation like this, a weakness. And I know other transit properties have been having the same challenge. We're comparing notes on the working groups we have with APTA, et cetera. So it is, it's not a permanent, we're not looking to double that staff. We need to staff it appropriately, and I think we'll look at that. But the main thing we have to make sure is that we have redundancy. So if one or two key people are out, or a group because of, they're cross-contaminated, some stuff they can do from home, but other stuff where they have to be there physically, we need to make sure that we have a backup, for those critical things like getting people paid. That's as basic as you can get, right? We have to make sure that we have redundancy and the ability, flexibility to be able to do that from multiple locations if one location is compromised or one group of people are compromised.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate the update. Thank you, guys.
Okay, thank you. Next is the Equal Employment Opportunity and Affirmative Action Update. Naeem Din.
Thank you, Joyce, and good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Naeem Din, Chief Office of EEO and Affirmative Action. We meet today, obviously, under very different circumstances compared with the last time we met. I'm going to give you some highlights before I get into my presentation. So this is the slide after the cover page. So as I was saying, during the coronavirus pandemic, while working remotely, we have continued to carry out the mission of our department in the three areas that fall within our responsibility: investigating complaints, providing training, and preparing and submitting New Jersey Transit's quadrennial EEO Affirmative Action Program. For complaint investigation, at the outset, we notified our employees that we are still working remotely and are available to address their concerns. We told them how they can reach us via telephone and email. We sent notices via email with our current contact information. We also placed notices on our office doors and asked that notices be placed in our facilities. Additionally, we placed notices on our intranet website, and we have continued to receive complaints while we are working remotely. As our presentation shows, we are using this time effectively and efficiently. For training, we continue to provide in-person and then remote harassment and discrimination prevention training to our employees. 77% of mostly non-agreement employees with an email address have been trained. In-person and remote training was provided to 103 employees during the first quarter of this year. New York state law requires employers in New York to provide annual training. In 2019, we train our employees who are stationed in New York City. We are currently evaluating various options as we decide on a most cost-effective method of acquiring and implementing a new learning management system in the second half of this year, which will enable us to fulfill our training requirements. Under EEO Affirmative Action Program, we are in the process of conducting a final review of our program before submission to the Federal Transit Administration by tomorrow, May 1st. The next slide provides the number of complaints that were opened and those that were closed. So we started 2020 with 107 open complaints. In January, 8 new complaints were filed and 5 were closed, thus ending the month with 110 open cases. In February, 5 new complaints were filed and 3 were closed, ending the month with 112 open complaints. In March, we received 4 new complaints and we closed 16 pending cases. Thus, we ended the month with 100 open complaints. Through April, we have continued to make progress in processing these complaints. And as of tomorrow, we will have around 87 complaints, which are currently open. The next slide shows the open cases by the basis of the complaint. That's on the left. The left pie chart shows the cases on the basis. And on the right-hand side, we have the complaints by action. So as you can see on the left-hand side, the most frequently cited basis was sex discrimination, which were 26% of the basis. Race discrimination was next at 15%. Religious discrimination was also at 15%. And discrimination based on color was 11%. The most frequently cited basis under action was allegation of non-sexual harassment, that's 44%, followed by allegations of sexual harassment, which was 17%. The last slide shows us the status of the cases that were closed, like how many cases were closed per year. So this is as of March 31st. So as of March 31st, most of the older cases have been closed. As you can see, 97% of the 2016 cases were closed as of March 31st. I'm happy to report that as of today, all of the 2016 cases have now been closed. For 2017 and 2018, roughly about 74 and 75% of the cases are closed, which means about 25% of cases are still left open from those years. For 2019, 55% of the cases were closed, and for the complaints filed this year, 29% of those have been closed. As you see at the bottom of the slide, it shows the cases that were closed in this reporting period, February and March, which years those cases were from. So as we continue to move forward, we continue to keep processing complaints and bringing cases to conclusion, not only from this year, but from prior years as well. And that concludes my report.
Thank you, Dean. Board Member Morocco, any questions or comments?
Just a comment. I'm certainly glad to hear that you are working towards figuring out how to give all employees harassment training, which, as you know, I think is critical to both preventing and redressing harassment, which, you know, based on your report, seems to be the majority of all harassment and discrimination claims fall under the category of harassment. And just like to reemphasize how important I think it is that everyone be trained, and I certainly look forward to your next report on your progress. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Certainly that is a goal that we share, and we continue to make efforts to extend that training to all of our employees. So I certainly look forward to reporting back to you at the next meeting.
Thank you. Board Member Adams, any questions or comments?
No questions, just a comment. It's a very good report. Thank you. And I, again, look forward to the continued progress in April.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate that.
Board Member Ajmani had to leave the meeting. Board Member Gordon, any questions or comments?
Yes, thank you very much for that report. I was just wondering, are there any metrics that we can use to compare our performance in terms of number of cases against peer organizations, or is there APTA data perhaps that provides national data? I mean, are we doing well or not compared with our peer organizations?
Yes, sir. I can give you some data, but I want to preface that by saying that all organizations are different. There's a different employee base, different organizations. So, I mean, certainly we can look at data. I'll give you shortly, but, you know, we have to keep in mind that we may not always be comparing apples to apples. But certainly within the state of New York, I have looked at the other agencies. For instance, the Corrections Department has 8,000 employees, and they had 171 complaints in 2019. Human Resources Department of the state of New Jersey, 7,000 employees and 98 complaints. Law and public safety, 6,000 employees, 174 complaints. Health department, 6,000 employees and 111 complaints. Looking across the Hudson at our sister agency, the MTA, they had at the end of 2019 some 73,000 employees, and they had 277 complaints. So that is some data that we can look at to see how we're doing in comparison with the other agencies.
Okay, that's helpful. I think in particular it would be useful to try to compare ourselves with other transit organizations where the work environments are similar and the stresses are similar. And I'd be if you're able to make some of that data available, I certainly would be interested in seeing it. But that was very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Board Member Rasmussen, any questions or comments?
Well, I would agree with Board Member Gordon that I agree that getting the information from, again, the sister railroads, perhaps Long Island Railroad, Metro North, SEPTA, again, and doing it, I think that's more of an apples-to-apples comparison. So that probably would be helpful as well. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Board members, that concludes the agenda for the Administration Committee. You may disconnect your telephone. Thank you.